That is our starting point this morning, Psalm 2. I have a prayer request that was called in Flora Whitehurst. She's in critical care. And her granddaughter, Kim Whitehurst, who's a work associate with Sherry Tracy. Kim takes care of Flora. Flora's in critical care. Kim's the granddaughter. And just pray for Kim. She needs physical and emotional strength. They both profess to be Baptists, and Kim professes to be saved. But just a heavy load. And then there is a choir rehearsal in the fireplace room right after Sunday school this morning. Psalm 2. Let's go there and read the psalm, and then we'll make our prayer. Psalm 2. Why do the heathen rage, and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves together, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed. That would be Christ. It would be Jesus. Matter of fact, that word anointed and Christ have the same meaning. Saying, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. This is incidental, but if you want a definition for rebellion, rebellion is thinking of authority as repression. The son has legitimate authority. Let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. Sometimes the words people use to describe things indicate their attitude about those things. I wouldn't say that what the Lord expects of us are bands and cords. He's not all about bands and cords, but a rebellious person would regard them that way. Let us break their bands asunder, cast away their cords from us. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Again, that's kind of a frightening verbal picture there, to have God up in heaven laughing at people. They say, we've had enough of God, and God laughs at them. That ought to be kind of terrifying. Then shall He speak unto them in His wrath, and vex them in His sore displeasure. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree. The Lord has said unto me, Thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. Ask of me, and I shall give thee the heathen for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron, thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Be wise now, therefore, O ye kings. Be instructed, ye judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear, and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest He be angry, and ye perish from the way, when His wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all they that put their trust in Him. Let's have a word of prayer, and then we'll go back to the psalm here for a few moments and then some other things. Lord, we pray that You give us understanding of Your Word this morning. Please bless not only this work, but every place that is true to Thy Word, where the Bible is faithfully taught and people come hoping to learn something about Thee. We do ask, Lord, that You would bless the efforts that were made today in reaching the lost with fruit and success. And we do pray, Lord, that saints would be edified, and God, above all things, would be glorified in us and through us today and in the week to come because of the time that we spent together. And give us understanding and light, illumination of Thy Holy Ghost. In Thy name we pray these things. Amen. Now, this is a second Advent psalm. It has to do with the Lord's return. And you can see several things in there that are clearly judgment and resemble Revelation 19 and other passages that have to do with the Lord's second coming. Verse number 9 especially, breaking them in pieces with a rod of iron, dashing them in pieces like a potter's vessel. But what I want to accent this morning is verse 10, 11, and 12 in particular. You have an attitude here among rulers that says, we don't really care about obeying the law of God. Here in the early part of the psalm, verse 2 and 3. We don't regard the law of God. Basically, you could summarize, paraphrase that attitude. Who cares about what God said about how we're supposed to run things? The kings and the rulers set themselves together, took counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed and said, let's not follow their laws. We don't care about God's law. We don't care about Christ's law. We're going to make our own laws. And of course, God is not mocked, is He? You can do that, and God's going to have the last laugh on any nation or people that take that attitude towards the law of God. And He says, I've already got my king. He's already set. Now again, we can take that prophetically, having to do with the second advent. But in a sense, it's an ongoing fact of the universe that Jesus Christ is already set as king. I mean, He's not going to become King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He already is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And so, again, this eternal thing about the decree of the Son, we'll pass over that for now. But point again in verse number 8, the heathen have been given to God, or given to Christ by the Father, as His inheritance. The uttermost parts of the earth. That tells me that all the nations of this world are supposed to be brought under the dominion of Jesus Christ. Now, one day, eventually, they will. When He returns, sets up His kingdom, all the kings of the earth are going to be subject to His ultimate sovereignty. But that does not mean that there is no obligation right now that kings observe His position and keep His law. And if kings fail to do those things, then there is a consequence for that. And again, though that verse has been used with regard to missions, William Carey, who's the father of modern missions, that was his motivating text right there. That was like the verse that he built his whole life's calling on. And I'm glad he did what he did. And I'm glad the verse touched him in that way. Please don't think I'm ridiculing it, but contextually, it's not about missions here. The context isn't about missions at all. Ask of me, and I will give thee the heathen for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Well, you know, just before that doesn't look like it has anything to do with missions, and just after that doesn't look like it has anything to do with missions. It has to do with dominion. The dominion of Jesus, and I realize that you're going to have to bring the gospel to a nation before the people in that nation are going to subject to the laws. So, there, you know, you can make that application of it, but I don't. This doesn't look like Matthew 28 to me. 18 to 20, you know, go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father. It doesn't look like the Great Commission. You know, and to me, yes, you can make a connection between them too, but it's not really about that. And then, be wise now, therefore, O ye kings, be instructed, ye judges of the earth. Kings and judges are to know these things. What? To serve the Lord, fear, rejoice with trembling, kiss the Son. No, again, what does it mean to kiss the Son? Well, in a political sense, again, thinking in terms of, you know, thrones and rulers and what kind of gesture that would mean for a king to kiss another king, that would be a sign of obeisance, wouldn't it? I mean, again, you know, this isn't an affectionate kind of a thing, you know. This isn't like some kind of two European guys, you know, kissing each other, or a couple of mafia guys kissing each other. It's not like that at all. It's a sign of obeisance. This is subjection. This is submission. You know, and I am pledging my devotion to you, you know. And it's a sign of submission and obeisance there. Serve the Lord with fear, rejoice with trembling, kiss the Son. It all goes together. Kiss the Son, lest He be angry and ye perish from the way. Say, well, there's a verse division. Again, that's not the way David wrote it. The verse divisions help us find things, and they're good. But that's not the way David wrote it. David wrote, serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling, kiss the Son, lest He be angry and ye perish from the way. You know, there's a continuity of the ideas here. Don't make a split where there isn't a split in a thought. And when His wrath is kindled but a little, blessed are all they that put their trust in Him. The fear of God isn't supposed to be an intimidating thing, by the way. It's supposed to be a liberating thing. Serve the Lord with fear. Rejoice with trembling. You know, I mean, God is to be feared, but it's to be a joyful thing, a joyful experience to serve and obey God. Now, we've been talking in Sunday school the last couple of weeks, and I plan on till the end of February. We're going to go into a unified quarter in March, but we've begun talking about these five components of government. And I'm being repetitious for a reason. Space repetition is the key to learning. If you hear a thing only once, it probably goes in one ear and out the other. But if you hear it soon enough,
but not too soon. You hear it soon enough. It's not left your mind yet. You hear it a second time. Then, oh, I've heard that before. And now it's beginning to become familiar. And several times you hear it in that kind of succession. And eventually it really sinks in. Now, there's five components of government: sovereignty, representation, law, jurisdiction, and continuity. And I hope you have them memorized by the end of February. Sovereignty, representation, law, jurisdiction, and continuity are the five components of government that we're discussing. We got as far as law. We're talking about law last week. We didn't finish with law, but we got going on law. And we talked about how the fact all governments follow some ethical code. It could be a perverse ethical code. It could be a righteous ethical code. But an ethical code exists. And the law, whoever makes the law of any society is the god of that society, because law is somebody's ethical code expressed socially in culture so that people are conformed to some model, some image of how they're supposed to behave themselves. We're talking about predestination Wednesday night a little bit, you know, and how God predestines by law. How do you make the future you want to see? You make the laws now that make everybody behave in such a way so that they become the future that you desire. You say, here's the laws, here, and people who disobey the laws, what happens to them? They're punished, right? You punish the people who don't obey the law. You put them in prison, or you fine them, or you exile them, whatever you do, however you punish those people, you punish them because they did not conform. And so after a while, the legislature today is shaping the world of tomorrow. Our nation tomorrow is based on what it will be is a reflection of the laws that are being passed today. You know, and again, once Bill Clinton got in the White House, that was a great cultural shift, because really that put the baby boomers in charge. And he was the first of our generation to actually make it to that point. And everybody before him was somewhat identified with the past, even the recent past, obviously, but an earlier day in a way of thinking. But Bill Clinton was the first icon of the baby boom generation. And the 8 years that he and his associates and assistants, the 8 years that they had, accomplished a great deal in shaping the future. They portrayed a certain attitude towards sexuality and moral fidelity or monogamy and lying and respect for your office and those kinds of things. All of that was communicated. And don't think for a minute that your kids and my kids and the kids in our generation, they weren't affected by that to some extent. Again, either they were taught to view it with disgust, or they accepted it and were taught to follow that example, one or the other. But believe me, they were acquainted with some things. You'd have to have your child completely isolated in a box, you know, for them not to be... I had a class in Bible college and theology, and I got teaching about some things under anthropology having to do with marriage, and a couple of girls, you know, really got offended at that. And I don't believe for a minute that they acted offended, but I don't believe for a minute they truly were offended. Otherwise, if they were offended by what I said in that classroom, they've been living in a box their entire teenage years, because they were teenagers during the Clinton administration. And how could you not get a newspaper? I mean, how could you get a newspaper, listen to the radio, or watch the news on television and not be acquainted with all kinds of things? You say, well, you know, there's places to talk about it and ways to talk about it. But to assume that they had no knowledge that there was this sort of thing, to me, is kind of naive. They never heard about that before. Well, man, where they been? It's been all over the place. I don't think they should have to have heard about it, but to pretend that they haven't is a little improbable to me. Anyway, these things have been introduced. You know, there's an attitude now. And the government is shaping the future, or the legislature is shaping the future. And, of course, the courts are involved at levels that they're not supposed to be. But we're supposed to render judgments. Go back to Romans 13 again. Those who are in authority are supposed to render judgments according to what is good and what is evil. Romans chapter 13 and verse number 4, 3 and 4. Once again, let every soul, verse 1, be subject unto the higher powers. What's the highest power? Right. Not just you subject to the laws that come out of Washington and Springfield, but the people in Washington and Springfield being subject to the laws that are above theirs. And whose law is above everybody's law? Now, not let every soul that doesn't write law be subject to the higher powers. Let every soul, including those who write laws, be subject to the higher powers. For there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. Now again, you and I are not supposed to be rebellious towards legitimate authority, but those who are given authority are not to be rebellious to God's authority. And in Psalm 2, we saw that there's an attitude in the world that says, let's throw off God's law. Let's throw off Christ's law. We don't care about their laws. We want to write our own laws. That attitude brings judgment. God laughs at it, and then He executes judgment against it. It's puny, insignificant, finite human beings. They got more in terms of power in common with a cockroach than they do with me. And they're going to shake their fist and blow the smoke of their rebellion up my nostrils. You know He must be merciful to let things go as long as He does, but He doesn't let them go on forever. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Good and evil. Where's that first show up? You know where that first shows up? Good and evil? Genesis 3. Right? The day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt be as God, right? God knows you eat that tree, you're going to know good and evil. And the whole problem with the fall was that Eve wanted to know for herself, to find for herself what was good and what was evil. Aaron Wyatt was telling me he's got a professor, and the professor said that the will of the majority is what determines law. And I gave him a couple of things, but I thought more in specific terms about that, Aaron. You know, 50% want plus one. Ask him if 50% plus one, if the will of the people was to have his, does he have any children? I'd ask him if he had any children. Ask him about his children. You know, and then, I mean, just really shock him. Say, well, what if 50% plus one decide to have your daughter for dinner? Or your son, whatever. Let's just say, you know, I mean, I know it's a hard, but does that make it just because the majority determined that it was? Would he at that point reject the determination of the majority as being just and valid? If that was their decision, would he still approve of it at that point? You know, again, it's really not that difficult to undermine that kind of thinking. Somewhere along the line, now again, it's reductio ad absurdum. You take the point and you draw it out to its furthest, most extreme conclusion. But then you show that the basic underlying argument is flawed, isn't it? Basically, if it's true that whatever the majority decides is law, and we just have to do whatever the majority decides, if that's what they decide, would we have to do it? Or would he at that point oppose it? Then philosophically, he really doesn't believe that the will of the majority is where law comes from. Law has to come from somewhere other than that. Again, if any man's law is valid, any man's law is valid. I know that's a horrible proposition, but I'm just trying to give you something that is far out there enough to shock him into thinking, well, in that case, no. You could get there sequentially, by the way. You know, you could suggest other things maybe a little bit at a time leading him in that direction. At some point, there's a breaking point. And then he's going to, you know, well, why would you object to it? If you accepted it here, and 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 then here's a breaking point, why all of a sudden do you become sovereign? He's saying, well, because, and he's going to say that there's just certain things, you know, that are just beyond toleration. And where does that come from? You take them to Romans chapter 1 and Romans chapter 2. They have a knowledge of God, and they have the work of the law, or the knowledge of the law written in their hearts. And anybody with any sense, but where does that knowledge come from? It comes from a final arbiter. That final arbiter is God. God would obviously be against that, regardless of what the majority said, and he would be right to oppose it. But he's wrong to give you the idea that you should do whatever the majority says just because the majority said so. That's not rule of... That's, again, a democracy is three wolves and two sheep deciding what to have for dinner by legislation or by election. Now, to determine good and evil is up to God, isn't it? Now, verse 4, again, Romans 13, "For he is a minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is a minister of God, a revenger, to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil." Now, again, you understand, we're in a perverse situation when the magistrate punishes somebody for holding a picket sign on a public sidewalk outside an abortion clinic, and protects the man inside who is executing mercilessly, brutally, unborn children for the sin or for the crime of being inconvenient. Again, I don't think the primary mission of the church is to close down abortion clinics. However, you understand that the mentality of a society that punishes protesters of abortion and protects purveyors of abortion is no longer aware of the difference between good and evil. And I say everybody has a syncretized worldview. Everybody has some combination of biblical and unbiblical principles. You can't help it, you're a sinner. You're not going to have perfect judgment. That's why we have to go to the Bible and see what the Bible says. And God's final. It really doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't matter what you like. It doesn't matter what you believe. It doesn't matter what the majority says. What matters is what God said, because only God can rightly define good and evil. And if He says a thing is good, then He says a thing is evil, then He's right, we're wrong, whether we can see it or believe it. We accept it. We would never come to that conclusion, maybe. But we know that God does not err. Rulers at all levels of government, then, are supposed to seek out God's law and apply them in their appropriate jurisdiction. Again, we've talked a little bit already in kind of in advance about jurisdiction. But again, I don't have jurisdiction over what my daughter's boss requires her to do at work. But I have jurisdiction over whether my daughter will work there or not. And we haven't had this ever happen, but if it happened that the boss said, "Well, this is something I want you to do," and she said, "Well, I don't want to do that," and she can negotiate with him, and if she feels like she's not getting anywhere, then she can ask her dad to negotiate for her, because after all, that I'm there to protect her. It's part of my role as a father, is to protect my daughter. And so, you know, if she likes the job, and this is not, you know, this is something that maybe we can talk about. You know, I mean, there are obviously some things that we wouldn't even be talking about, but there may be something we can talk about and say, "Well, how about this instead of that? Suggest an alternative." You know, it might be fine. That's my job to step in and intervene. And if he says, "No, it's going to have to be this way, and my daughter's convictions are against it, and my convictions are against it," then I say, "Fine, you can hire somebody else to do that job, but my daughter's not going to do that job." But I can't tell him how to run his office, because I don't have any jurisdiction in his office. He has jurisdiction in his office. I have jurisdiction over my daughter. He has jurisdiction over certain things he expects of her, and as long as they're reasonable, as his employee, when to show up, how late to stay, what to do while she's there, as long as he's reasonable, I've got no problem with it. But it's my duty to protect my daughter, and so my jurisdiction extends to a certain extent into his office. As long as she's safe there, then that's all right. But if she's not safe there, then she's not working there. And somebody else can let their daughter work there, but that's not going to be mine. And I said, I don't care if she's 21 or 25 or 45 if she's under my roof. And if I have anything to say about who it is she marries, and I think I will, I'm going to put her hand in the hand of a young man who's going to protect her the same way. And if he's not, I don't want him. If he's a wimp, if he's a pushover, if he's not strong, if he's not going to be the head of his home, she'll wrap him around her finger. And I don't want that. I want somebody strong. So, you know, we're waiting for that. Anyway, somebody strong enough to handle her is going to not turn her up easily. But all... Sorry about that. Family laws, ecclesiastical laws, civil laws, they all relate back to God's law. And all citizens of all nations, here's the thing that people don't understand, all citizens of all nations are obligated to follow God's law. No person is exempt. Let's take a verse here, Leviticus 24, verse number 22. I don't know if we saw this or not, but some of this stuff is so contrary to popular opinion and conventional wisdom that if I taught the same lesson for weeks in a row, for 3 or 4 months in a row, it probably wouldn't be overdone to state the same thing that many times just to contradict what you're hearing, what you've heard before. Leviticus 24:22, you shall have one manner of laws, well for the stranger as for your own country, for I am the Lord your God. You understand that Belshazzar in Daniel chapter 5 invoked the judgment of God upon himself and his kingdom because he took the vessels from the temple and used them in a blasphemous manner that was more than God was willing to put up with from him. They had captured those vessels in Daniel chapter 1 and taken them down to Babylon, but nobody before Belshazzar had dared to use them in the way that he did. But he's having this big feast, this big celebration. God only knows what kind of abominations were going on there. The Bible's not explicit in that particular case, but we know that all kinds of abominable things went on in those kind of events. And all these abominable things are going on, and Belshazzar says, hey, bring up all the vessels from the temple down there in Jerusalem that my father Nebuchadnezzar captured. And God says, buddy, you just put the straw on the camel's back that broke it. And the handwriting's on the wall. Many, many tekel upharsin. They went too far in that perspective. You say, now, you know, well, he's not subject to the law, right? He's a pagan emperor, a pagan Gentile king, and why should he have to obey God's law? Because it's for all nations. And I'll show you where it comes from in a minute. But you remember, again, Herod got a little cocky there in Acts chapter 12. And he preached made a pretty good speech. And they said, boy, it's the voice of a god. And he kind of welcomed that praise. And then he was eaten up by worms. He's saying there's a point at which you've just gone too far. Now, take this in light of John 19:15. You know what it says, but let's go over there. John chapter 19, verse number 15. Pilate presents the Lord to the Jews in verse 14. He saith unto the Jews, behold your king. They cried out, away with him. Away with him. Crucify him. Pilate said unto them, shall I crucify your king? The chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. Now they had Psalm 2. They had all the Psalms. They had Psalm 2. They knew that it said, kiss the Son, lest he be angry with thee. And instead of kissing the Son, they didn't do obeisance to the Son. They said, we'll take Caesar over him. And Roman Empire, Holy Roman Empire, Roman Catholic Church, or whatever it is, they've been under that and oppressed by it and persecuted by it and hunted by it and tormented by it ever since. Did you ever think about this? You ever notice all the stuff in the Bible about agriculture in the Old Testament? I mean, when God says, I'm going to judge you, so I'm going to cut your rain off and your crops won't grow. And then, Abraham, the first Hebrew, right? He was a shepherd. Amos, gatherer of sycamore fruit. David was a shepherd. All these shepherds and all these agricultural people and all this agricultural image. You know, did you know? You know, the Bible says that if they reject the Messiah, that the earth will not yield its fruit to them any longer. When's the last time you met a Jewish farmer? Oh, narrow-minded, bigotist, racist, sexist, homophobic, blah 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 blah. I know, I don't. But I mean, just don't start screaming racism about this. When was the last time you met a Jewish farmer? They're not agricultural people. They're city people. I mean, they're tailors and they run clothing stores and they're lawyers and they run restaurants and they automobile dealerships or they're doctors or whatever. But I don't know of any Jewish farmers. You see, drive through Skokie, you see any farmland out there? Is that what they do for? No. You say, why is that? Because there's one race of people that, and you scream racism all you want to, scream, but you understand, it was God that said that the earth would not yield its fruit to them. And there's one race of people that God said, you can't make a living off the land anymore. And when God says you can't make a living off the land anymore, guess what? If God said it, it doesn't really matter what anybody else thinks about it or how bigoted it sounds. If God said you're not going to make a living off the land anymore, you're not going to make a living off the land anymore. And so they go from nation to nation, to nation. And there's only two countries in the world that have not persecuted the Jews, and that's Holland and the United States. It's been more severe in some places than others. But you know, Spain, of all the countries in Europe, was the most liberal towards the Jews until Ferdinand. And when Ferdinand and Isabella, you know, Christopher Columbus sailed the Ocean Blue, 1490. That Ferdinand right there, just about the time that Columbus discovered America, Ferdinand discovered the... And then severe persecution came up. And isn't it kind of a strange thing? And here's Spain with its armada and its position in almost the center of the world. I mean, stuck out there on that Iberian Peninsula, way out on the west part of Europe. They had more exposure to the ocean than probably any other nation in Europe, and had a more powerful navy than any other nation in Europe, and had the potential of maybe being the country that took the Word of God around the world. But instead, God shut them down. God shut the nation of Spain down. And that huge armada was defeated by about 20 little ships, little British ships in the English Channel, defeated them. And then what made it out of the English Channel got destroyed in a storm on its way back. God wiped them out. They never did recover from that. See, now, the Jew is promised to be hunted and persecuted because they said, we'll have no king but Caesar. But he also said those who do it are going to be punished for doing it. And now, anti-Semitism is really growing. There's a new anti-Semitism growing in Europe. Very, very hostile attitude towards the Jew in Europe again. It's all going to be repeated. I'm for them. I'm not against them. I believe that they're God's chosen people, and you better treat them right or God's going to deal with you. But he's the one who said they're going to have a hard way to go. And they're the ones who said we have no king but Caesar. And so they took the rule of a man who, again, professed to be God at that point. He was a false god. He professed to be God incarnate. That started with Augustus. In the days of Caesar Augustus, Luke chapter 1, you know, a decree went forth that all the world should be taxed. Started with, this is Tiberius here, but it started with Augustus that they started regarding Caesar as a god. We have no king but Caesar. We'll take another god, and we'll take the laws that that god makes. Instead of the laws that our God wrote in His Word, we'll take the laws of that god. And when you make that decision, you see, when a people that have had the Bible, they've had the, all people are accountable to it. But when the people that have actually had the written statutes, God has been gracious enough to them to spell it out. Not just give it to them in their heart, and we'll see that in a little bit, but He actually goes to the trouble of spelling it out for them. And they turn away from that. Severe and devastating judgment is what's to follow. You see the predicament that our country's in. Because at one time, we acknowledged that the foundation of our law was to be this book. And can you honestly say that the foundation of our law today, any new law, there's still laws in effect from the past that have not been replaced that are in accordance with this. But this is being undermined all the time. And there's a never-ending, ongoing culture war in a process to try and replace it. Again, and there's ups and downs in the battle. I'm not saying we lose every battle. This thing with gay marriage, you know, I mean, that thing's really being fought out. And I'm the state of Ohio passing their law, the 38th state, to actually make a law against same-sex marriages. That makes enough to have a constitutional amendment. And so we've got enough states that have that position. Now, again, if we still had the senators appointed by the state legislature, then that would be even better. But we have the senators democratically elected. So it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to go that way. But you know, it's a good sign. It's a good thing. More states are against it officially than are for it officially. But it doesn't mean that they're not going to keep pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing until they get it changed. Again, do we want to hear man's duty to God, personally or civilly? No, we have no king but Caesar. But Jesus Christ is King of Kings. Kiss the Son. And another king means another law. You kiss Caesar's toe instead of Jesus' toe, and now you have exchanged what God says is good for whatever that king says is good, and what God says is evil for whatever that king says is evil. And again, no magistrate's exempt. Here's a look at Psalm 119. This is David talking, Psalm 119. Those who've had the Bible are more accountable, but those who haven't had the Bible are still accountable. Psalm 119, verse number 46. David said, I will speak of thy testimonies also before kings, and will not be ashamed. How about Proverbs chapter 8? Proverbs chapter 8. David says, I'll tell the other kings what God's law is. Proverbs chapter 8, verse number 15. By me, this is the chapter that has to do with wisdom. I don't believe that it is Christ pre-incarnate because he's possessed in the first place. Verse number 22, the Lord possessed me, and possessing is not personality. And Jesus Christ was eternally a person, not a possession of God. He was eternally the person of God. So it's not just wisdom is not Christ, or Christ is not wisdom incarnated. He is wisdom incarnated, but he's more than that. And wisdom is not just speaking here of Christ. It's speaking of wisdom, not as Christ. But anyway, the verse is verse number 15. By me kings reign and princes decree justice. By me princes rule and nobles, even all the judges of the earth. And again, that is a responsibility of rulers to judge wisely, to rule wisely, to make decisions based on wisdom, and wisdom is a possession of God. Now this brings us to jurisdiction. And by the way, it also relates to continuity. The last two things we have to talk about are jurisdiction and continuity. But if a ruler, even a ruler outside of Israel, rejects God's law, then that breaks down his continuity. As long as a nation holds God's law, that nation is promised continuity. And empires rise and empires fall, sometimes from internal deterioration, sometimes from invasion from outsiders, sometimes a combination of both, usually some combination of both. They're weakened internally so they can be attacked by outsiders. But in every case, it's always the same. They rejected God's law. Now, jurisdiction is the authority to enforce sanctions. We're looking for a definition of jurisdiction. We've only got 5 minutes, but we can venture into jurisdiction a little bit. Just having law is not enough. There has to be legitimacy to enforce the law. Now, go back to Genesis chapter 13, verse number 13. Genesis chapter 13, verse number 13. There's about five verses I want to look at quickly and make a conclusion out of it. The men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. Now, there's no Bible written, was there? I mean, this is written after the fact. Abraham comes along after this, and Abraham's there at the time. It's 2000 B.C. Again, 2000 B.C. is the appearance of phonetic writing. There's no phonetic writing before 2000 B.C. It's all hieroglyphic, ideographic, symbolic kind of language, like Dick and Jane, or Chinese. But phonetic writing shows up in 2000 B.C., and that's why the word of the Lord came to Abraham. But it's not written down till Moses. Moses is the first one, or maybe Job, but to actually write down, using phonetic language, to write down the words of God. But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. Well, how could they be sinners before the Lord if they, you know, didn't somehow know what it was that God expected of them? Genesis chapter 19, verse 4. Let's pile these things up and then make our conclusion. Verse 4, but before they lay down, the men of the city, even the men of Sodom, compassed the house round, both young and old, all the people from every quarter, and they called on Lot and said unto him, where are the men which came in to thee this night? Bring them out unto us, that we may know them. And so we know what happened there. Now go to Leviticus chapter 18. Leviticus chapter number 18. Verse number 22. Thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. It is abomination. You know, you ought to study that word abomination, see all the things it refers to in the Bible. But that's an abomination. Now, they wanted to do it, and they were wicked and sinners before the Lord because that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to do that abomination. Also, Leviticus chapter 20 and verse number 13. If a man also lie with mankind as he lieth with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood shall be upon them. You say, well, those Sodomites down in Sodom, they didn't know that God had this opinion about these things because it wasn't written yet. Moses, 430 years after Abraham. So how could they know they were doing something wrong? See, I mean, here they are doing it, and God says, you do that, you'd be put to death. And guess what they were? They were put to death, right? God executed the whole bunch of them. The nation... I'm jumping ahead. Look at Romans chapter 1 and verse number 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath showed it unto them. For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse, because that when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain their imaginations, their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man, Santa Claus, birds, a turkey, four-footed beast, the Easter bunny, the creeping things, that's Halloween. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts, to dishonor their own body between themselves. It trains the truth of God in a lie and worshiped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. They're sex worshippers. For this cause, God gave them up unto vile affections, for even their women did change the natural use into that which is against nature. And likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in her lust one toward another, men with men, working that which is unseemly, and receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was meet. And it goes on and gives a more graphic description yet. But you understand, God had made His law known in the hearts of men, including the men of Sodom, and the men of Sodom couldn't say, well, we didn't know that what we were doing was wrong. No, they said, we knew it was wrong, and we chose to reject it. And they didn't have it written down except for in their hearts, but they knew it there. Look at Genesis chapter 26. And this is related. Genesis chapter 26 and verse number 5. Now, God has the authority to enforce the sanctions. If He gives that authority to somebody else and they don't enforce it, then He enforces the sanctions on those who He authorized to enforce them and were failed to. Genesis 26:5. Because that Abraham obeyed My voice and kept My charge, My commandments, My statutes, and My laws. Now, where did Abraham get them? There's a silly cult out there that believes that Adam had a complete King James Bible in the Garden of Eden. Yeah, I don't believe that. I believe Adam spoke King James Bible English in the Garden of Eden. And I think I can make a case for that. But to have a complete King James Bible, Genesis through Revelation, the Garden of Eden, is pushing it a little too far. But there's a group that believes that. I don't believe that. But how did Abraham keep God's charge, commandments, statutes, and laws? Because he had them right here. And if Abraham had them right here, and again, the law wasn't written until 430 years after that. If Abraham had them right here, the men of Sodom had them right here too. And you got them right here. I mean, again, do you have it all just right? Of course you don't. That's why God graciously gave us a written out, spelled out version of the law that was perfect so that we could appeal to it instead of our inner moral compass. But you know what? Your inner moral compass is probably closer to right than wrong most of the time. And when somebody does wrong, they're doing it against what they know. See, they're choosing good and evil for themselves. The nations of the world are still obligated to follow God's laws. Now again, the laws that Abraham had in his heart and the laws that the Sodomites had in their hearts, two men or two groups responding entirely differently to the same information. But you understand, in most states in America, most of the states in the United States, sodomy is still a crime. Now, is that law enforced? It's rarely punished, right? But God says, whatsoever man sows, that shall he also reap. So finally God says, all right, listen, if they're not going to enforce the laws against sodomy, I will. And he gives them AIDS. So AIDS is a horrible disease. No, it's a wonderful cure. AIDS is not a disease. AIDS is a cure. And there's myth of heterosexual. I realize every now and then a heterosexual gets AIDS. But the people, for the most part, that have AIDS, got AIDS by engaging in sexual activity that they shouldn't have been. If you had monogamous marriage, see, you're not going to have that problem. But outside of it, so what about the intravenous drug user? Well, you know, again, I wish it was just limited to homosexuals, but we're not going to say that intravenous drug users are the pillars of morality in society. Generally, they have other things going on as well as that. You know, I was never an intravenous drug user. I used anything that I didn't have to put in my veins. I mean, in my mouth, up my nose, it did, you know, but nothing. I was scared of the needles. And not only that, but I had Bo Stedman and James Stedman, their older brother. I saw what happened to him and his best friend, Larry Brown. And these were guys that were really like heroes to me. I mean, they rode choppers. They were into pagans. They were, you know, they were just serious bad dudes, always had chicks around. And when they started using heroin, I mean, they sold their bikes. And the heroin became more important to them than the women. And I thought, and these guys were way badder than I was. And I thought, well, if that'll do that to them, then it'll do that to me. So if I'm not as bad as they are and it did that to them, then I can't handle it. But anything else. Because I knew some intravenous drug users. And let me just tell you something, they weren't really moral people. They had a lot of other things going on. I mean, just, you know, whatever they got from that needle, they probably had coming. Because they had a whole lot of stuff. They weren't just, you know, these really, really decent people who just happened to be intravenous drug users, and that was the one thing about their life that was kind of weird and out of whack, and the rest of their life was just, you know, exemplary. You know, so yeah, I'm saying AIDS is a cure. It is God's judgment. Again, you say, hey, and I'd much rather he do it through a virus than to do it with hellfire and brimstone rain down on a country. I mean, I'm thankful for it. I don't want them to find a cure. I don't think they're going to. But if they do, I'll tell you what, something worse will come along. Because God is not mocked, see? And instead, they said, we'll take Caesar, and we'll take his law, and we'll decide for ourselves what's good and what's evil, and this is what they get for it. And it's only going to get worse. It's either going to get heavier and harder and more devastating, and the judgment is going to be more and more severe, or there's going to have to be revival, and people are going to say, we'll take God's law because our way has cost us too much. But we can't just continue to play around. Things are moving one way or the other. Revival or ruin, social ruin or revival. Let's be dismissed. You got 10 minutes before church. Good crowd in the back, though, by the way, but I'm not as late as it looks by looking out the windows. Choir rehearsal. Ha ha.